This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
In October 2022, Dunedin Writers and Readers Festival was privileged to host a discussion about Tangata Ngāi Tahu, People of Ngāi Tahu, Volume 2, tracing the history of the Otago region through the Ngāi Tahu people of Araiteuru. The kōrero was facilitated by Wairiki Parata Taiapa, who led co-editors Helen Brown and Dr. Michael J. Stevens, and contributing author and chair of Te Runanga o Otakau, Edward Allison, as they talked about the process of working with Ngāi Tahu communities to produce a resource that is a taonga for future generations.
The whānau e pāua mā tōa mā tamariki mokopuna. Tēnā rā koutou katoa i ngā whānau tautoko. Ka nui ngā mihi atu ki a koutou, ko tā mā nei koutou e whakanui tēnei pō. I kaupapa nunui mō mātou e kōrero ana chi ai, e pāna ko tātou nei mātua tūpuna. O te tāi o Araiteuru, ko tēnei mihi atu. Kia rātou, ko wehi atu ki te pō, i maumahara ana tā o rātou. Nō reira, ka nui te kō, ki te ana, koutou katoa, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou. Ko tēnei mihi o te wā nei, kia rātou, kua ngāro, ngā mate, o te wā atu wehi, marama me te tau nei, ngā mate haere, haere atu rā. Kāti, ka huri anō ki te kaupapa o te rā nei, te huinga, i roto o tēnei whare, pūpiri, kei roka te kaupapa o te rā nei, nō reira, tēnā koutou. Great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight, and to take this time to talk and discuss, reminisce important tūpuna to us all, who connect to this coast, Araiteuru. So, pleasure to have you here. I'll just open our hui with a karakia. Mai e te tipua, mai e te tāpito, mai e te ka hui o ngā ariki, mai e te tāpifi o ngā atua. Hui takana te mauri, ko te mauri i ahua nō ki runga. Ki inai taura, ki inai tau i rā. Ki tau te mauri ke runga, inai tama, ka puta ki te whaiao, ki te ao marama, uhi, wero, haramai te tōki, haumi e hui e, tāki e.
Ti hei maurara, a tūtahi ake kia koe Edward, ai te pāwhakawairua kia whakariterite tō tātai hui, kia tukunatura noho ki te whakaronui ki te wāhingaro no reira mihi ana kia koe te paua, me te whakatūwhera noho te kaupapa ko horane e mihi ana te nā koe. O ti anō rā koutou kua karahuihui mai ne ki tēnei o ngā kaupapa nui whakaharahara nei, a tēnā koutou, haramaira, haramaira ki tēnei whare kōrero, kua whakaritea, kia hangaia tēnei whare kōrero o tā ukiuki, o te anō rā tēnei whare kōrero o tātou o nāianei no reira mihi ana. Kātahi kārua ki ngā pai kōrero nei, ko ngā kōrero, ehia nei ngā tau, ko āta wete wete, ko āhua whakatefa tefa, wene kōrero o rātou, ma hei aha, hei kai mā te mata o ngā tamariki mokopuna, moho anō nei tatu aturaki o tātou kaumātua. E tika ana, he kite ngā kanohi, he hoki ngā mahara, he koa ngā ngākau, he pike ngā wairua, nō reira tēnā koutou o te anō rā, kei ngā whānau, a koutou ngā kai tuku kōrero, koutou ngā puna maumahara, koutou ngā kai pupuri te mauri o ngā kōrero, tēnā koutou. Ko whai whakaro mai nei kia harama i tēnei pō. Ki te noho i te puāhurutanga o te puna maumahara, no reira mihi ana ki a koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Kia ora everybody, I stand here really briefly to lay the foundations of our whare, because that's what we're going to do tonight. You know, when we think about those strong pillars, those strong whare that we had of those of the time of our kaumātua and our ancestors, and then through the process of colonization and you know, with some of those certain aspects of our history being lost, erased, here we are once again tonight to rebuild that whare. And in that, that whare is of the memories, those collective memories that we're all going to comfortably seat, listen, and share in the memory of, in remembrance and celebration of those of old, but also us, and many of us who are seated here, the descendants of those So before we get into the kaupapa, just some health and safety toilets are back there to the right. And in case of an emergency, yeah, just out there on the field outside the building. Kapai. So, kapai, it's definitely an honour and a privilege for me to kind of facilitate, mediate, maybe interrupt at times, try just manage our time and get through this beautiful conversation that we have planned for us today. I'm going to briefly introduce our kai kōrero here alongside me on stage, and then we'll get into our kōrero. So, you know, I got here and I was hoping that they would introduce themselves, and I said, oh, yeah, you can introduce yourselves. And then Helen said, no, you can introduce us. And I said, oh, here I am scratching my head going, I haven't really planned anything to introductions, but, you know, there's kōrero, you know, my father used to say that, you know, he kano he kitia, these are faces that are most, that are seen often. And these are some of our kano he kitia within our iwi, kaitahu, kāti, māmoe, and waipaha. And many of you know these faces before you, but we do have an original Bluffy down at the end of this this panel here. Bluffy Dr. Michael Stevens, all the way from Bluff. Multiple, we'll give a round of applause. And also to his right, we have the beautiful Helen Brown. Also, her tipuna, Te Wharerimu Pātahi, we share the same common ancestress, Wharerimu, all the way from Whenua Hau. Give a round of applause to Helen Brown. me taku pāpā noho ki taku upoko whakahirahira, Pau Edward Ellison. Edward grew up at the Kaike Ōtāko, a familiar face here within our centre, our city, and also the upoko of our marae at Ōtāko. Ko mai te pakapu. They might want to extend on their mihi, and I will leave that for them to do. But I will just, before I take my seat, I will just lay a bit of a foundation of our kōrero and then start asking some questions and having a conversation. So Tāngata Ngai Tahu Volume 2 is the second in a series of biographical volumes produced by the Ngai Tahu Archive. This volume, like its 2017 predecessor, features short 50 biographies of Ngai Tahu people, is richly illustrated and is co-published by Te Reunanga o Ngai Tahu and Bridget Williams Books. The conversation we're going to have tonight is around our local Araituru coastline, inland, and those kaumātua that feature in this volume too from our local area here. Nō reira, tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou. Let's start with my first question to you, Mike. What was the catalyst for the Ngai Tahu Archive to undertake this biographical work?
Well, there was a volume one.
Let's start with volume one. That's a good place to start.
It stands to reason there would be a volume two. More broadly, I guess the question is about why as a people, as a tribe, would we do this? You know, we live in a world of limited resources. Doing this means not doing something else. So why have we prioritised this? And there's two things, and these are two little tīpuniisms. He can be the ghost at the wedding, and then we'll move on. But one is his little saying that, you know, we as a people have to remember. And so this is a material or concrete demonstration or an example of that little saying of his. The second point is sort of an actual specific catalyst occurred on Hereford Street pre-quake, you know, in Te Wai Pounamu House. And there was one of the hallways there which had, there was these black and white sort of portrait photographs taken in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was sort of a rogues gallery, as Rick Toe Sr. and others. And anyway, someone, it may have been Rahapiti Ramson, someone had passed away, and Tiffany just made a comment walking past, said, there's another one gone. And the young, you know, buck sort of tending to on that day said, who is that? And he was quite surprised, he didn't know. And he said, in the end, he said, name any of these people. And he couldn't. And he went into the office and he said, get out here, start rattling off names. And no one could. And his point was, these aren't people from the 1880s or the 1890s, they're from the 1980s and the 1990s. And so as a historian, he found that really interesting, the nature of memory, that you could lose it so quick. But as a sort of tribal scholar, out of statesman, he was terrified at how quickly our collective memory of people goes. And so that was one of the triggers for this whole project. And that's particularly true, you know, and you made quite proper reference, Wairihi, to so many in the audience being descendants of people, well, in volumes 1 and 2, as I look out. But we also have a lot of people who were big wheels in their day, who carried a lot of authority, carried an enormous amount of responsibility within and beyond their papatipu, but they had no children, or they had children but no mokopuna, and so they are ghosts now. And so part of what we're doing is actually retrieving their memory. So we're trying to hold the memory of people who already know, people who have just passed away in the last few years, for example, but also retrieve the memory of people who were at risk of vanishing altogether. So I think that speaks to some of the motivations for the Tribal Biographies project. And just the last point I'd like to make, and this is not a plea for ongoing employment, although that's in this, which is this ought to be a routine part of our existence. Right? This isn't a nice to have when times are good. This is something we should always do. This is one of the sort of carrying costs of being a tribe, if you will, is this. So there'll be, you know, it's a tribal series without end.
Mm. Kia ora, tēnā koe. We had volume 1 going into volume 2, and I guess there was a slight a shift in going into volume 2. Helen, I guess, would you be able to tell us about the kaupapa of mana wahine in particular to this volume 2?
Kia ora. Wairiki, ngā mihi mahana ki a koutou. Just to add to Mike's kōrero about the first volume.
It's been like this for 3 years.
It was hugely actually developed, that book, in response to the 20th anniversary of the Ngaitahu Deed of Settlement. And because of that, there was a lot of emphasis on men who, whilst our wahine had been integrally involved with that whole story and that whole process, there ended up being a lot of biographies of Ngaitahu men who'd been on the trust board, involved with as negotiators for the settlement. So there are a lot of group photographs of men in that book, and to be fair, it kind of bothered me a bit at the end once we'd got through that project. And so with this volume, I was determined that we'd sort of rectify that gender imbalance. But having said that, it was actually really difficult to, even though constantly in front of mind was this wish to include as many stories of women as possible, invariably the list just so readily would fill up with the names of men. And I mean, we all know that this is just what happens with history generally. But anyway, we ended up with a majority of wahine in this volume. I think there are 28 of the 50 are women. The majority of our authors are wahine as well. Part of, I guess, the synergy of that being an emphasis or a theme of this volume was that we started work on it in 2018, which was the 125th anniversary of women's suffrage in New Zealand. And that led to the elevation, I guess, of stories of women, of course, associated with that suffrage kaupapa, which is largely a Pākehā story, and I was involved in some projects in that space at that time, but it also highlighted the need for us to be promoting Māori women's stories, just generally. So Wahine are at the heart of this book, and as all of us who are Ngaitahu know, Wahine have always been central to Ngaitahu culture and identity, and there's no better, I guess, symbolic and visually beautiful way of emphasising that point than in Tahu Potiki at Awarua in the beautiful Po Wahine. And many of us here are descended from those women who are represented in that whare. And I could lead into talking about one of the women in the book.
Yes.
So a key part of this project is it's a huge collaboration, and I look out and I see many faces, some whom I've only met in person this evening, who have been integrally involved with this project over the 4 years that it's taken to create it. But a sort of central tenet of the project is the involvement of whānau, of descendants, in either writing biographies of their tipuna or co-writing with other members of the Ngaitahu archive team, or just being, you know, involved, I guess, as, how would I say, just making sure that we've got it right. I was able to write about one of my tipuna in this volume, and that's a woman whose story is tied into this region. Her name is Pātahi. Her story is best known through the recording of a gold prospector who met her in 1863 on the West Coast, and he was staying with her and her partner, Haimona Tuako, and they were prospecting for gold, Haimona and Pātahi, and William Martin's his name, and he stayed with them. And one evening, Pātahi recounted to him her life story. And that story is reasonably well known. It's a compelling story, but it is also problematic. There's sort of lots of holes in it, which point to, I guess, the unreliability of Pātahi as a narrator. Whether that's partly to do with the recorder, the Pākehā gold prospector who recorded the story, or to Pātahi's creative license, we'll never know. But it's a wonderful account that provides us with a rare and intimate glimpse into the life of a Ngaitahu woman in the 19th century. And we don't have a photograph of her, but we do have photographs of her children. So she had two daughters. Her partner was Edwin Palmer, and you know he's well known in terms of his association with the colonial history of Otago. I think in Toitū he might be in that chronology of portraits on the wall. I think he's the first one. Actually, when I came in this afternoon, I went out to Henley, which I often do, to the urupā. But then I also, which I don't often do, is went to Otakaia, to the urupā where Edwin Palmer is buried. Because I guess even though he's my tipuna, I don't tend to. I've cast him as a villain because he is cast as such in Pātahi's account of her life story. But my research for this biography has led me to re-look at that. He may not be the villain, and she may well have abandoned her children. So the story is that Edwin abandoned Pātahi and took her two children when he remarried a Pākehā wife. But the timing of that whole story doesn't make sense because the two daughters, Tini, who's my tipuna, and Betsy were in their 20s when Palmer remarried Beatrix Fowler, who was his Pākehā wife. But the reason why I kind of make this point is that part of the project and our working with families is that we do uncover, discover, recover aspects of our history that's been lost or distorted or that we've got wrong. And that's a wonderful part of the process, but we have to deal with it with sensitivity and respect. Getting back to Patei, she's an interesting character, leads a peripatetic lifestyle. She ends up on Banks Peninsula for a decade. Her children are raised by their father, Edwin, largely it would seem. And then ultimately she's on the West Coast. She's a Pounamukawa. As I said, she's a gold miner. There's wonderful records in Martin's diary of her fishing, of her swimming. So when the Taramakau is in heavy flood, he's amazed to see her swim across the river to rescue her waka, which is going to be lost downstream. So an obituary really written by Haimona, published in Te Wānanga. And these are some of her descendants at Puketaraki. Patahi didn't receive any land. She's one of these women who also kind of floats, like there are a number of them in terms of Ngāi Tahu whakapapa. Her whakapapa is ambiguous, and because she didn't receive any land allocations, she actually, there's no Papatipu Runanga that she actually is strongly attached to. You know, I mentioned that she spent 10 years on Banks Peninsula. She's part of a whole group of Ngāi Tahu women on Banks Peninsula who are kind of part of the really early Ngāi Tahu diaspora who sort of float free and, well, that's one term, or else they're kind of lost. And she's one of them, but I guess her daughters anchor her in a sense. So Betsy at Puketaraki, because she comes under the mantle of Puketaraki, because she ends up having land there, and Tini at Tairi, because that's where she gets land allocation. So that's just one wahine in the book.
Kia ora, hello. Just following on with that theme of our wahine, to yourself, Edward, I recall spending some time with you in the process of the Tikai Atarangatira publication, and in conversation with you and I, you spoke fondly and vividly about the tawa, and you made the comment that, you know, definitely going through the Ngāi Tahu claims settlement process, you know, that your tawa were your backbone. Would you be able to share a little bit about, you know, about the role of our tawa and our wahine whilst you were growing up?
Kia ora, Waiariki. That question and my thinking about it, being involved at Otako, being involved in not necessarily the marae, just even the social occasions when I was young, in growing up and eventually being involved in the marae, there was always a strong tawa presence. And when I was young, probably the most prominent one was Auntie Alice, Arihi Karatai, who was born in 1862, and she was revered by everyone, carried a lot of mana, and she was a spinster. She was the oldest girl of Timothy Karatai and Hariata Robertson, and so I think for that reason her role was looking after her brothers and sisters, who one of them was my grandmother. But so I think that sort of influence of when I was young, if she was present at a picnic, it wasn't so much in those days marae things, it might be church or something like that. Her presence commanded respect. Mm. And that influence she had, I think she was always being the mother to everyone, I suppose. And so you sensed that, and then you saw that in others as well, her nieces or the children of her cousins and what have you. I think it's always been a strong presence at Otako for me. Why is that? And if you look back in the history, it's been strong as well. Of course, it's a tandem role. You know, these things, we don't do things men alone, but there's always women involved. But if I think back from my youth and coming through, when I did get involved in the marae, I had some very important aunties there. And longevity is quite a big part of that, I think. Some of them lived to 103 and were quite staunch. would tell you what was what. And influential, really. And why was that? The men, they were important men, certainly were, but they generally died younger, quite a lot younger. And I think that is an element in the kōrero. Tarawai Wesley was very important for me when I was young, but he died, he was about 63, if that. And Uncle Rani, very important in what he did with the cooperative and all the fishermen, all the Ngaitaha fishermen south of Timaru and beyond. But so we had very important men, but not. And then there was the wars. Some of those men either they were wounded and didn't come back well, or suffered when they were back and didn't last long or didn't have long lives. So there's all of that, and then they had to work hard. They didn't have perhaps the education that they may have if they'd had those opportunities, the men. And so they had to provide. So there's quite a lot of kōrero in this, but in my experience, and it's still the same today, we have marae meetings, mostly dominated by wahine. It's fine. Where are you guys? But that's true. No, it just seems to be a feature. And it's been a theme that I've seen. And if we've looked back through this book and the previous book, there's elements of that. So just perhaps if I do expand on Auntie Alice, she was born in 1862. And why she got the name Alice, or Arihi, was that the Victory ran aground on what is now Victory Beach on the outside of the Otago Peninsula. And Captain Toogood and his crew were taken to Timothy Karatai's house, who would have been the elder in the area in those days, to be looked after. And Hariata was pregnant, and they got talking, and they suggested, oh, well, you might be able to give us a name for our child, not knowing whether it'd be a girl or a boy. But he suggested, oh, why not call it after Queen Victoria's daughter, Alice, and that's how that name came to be. And they were on a farm up on the Wairi, overlooking Pohekura, Timoti. Timoti was the son of Chief Karatai, and he had allocated land along from Pohekura right back toward Pepe Karatu. And so Auntie Alice grew up there, looking after all her brothers and sisters and helping on the farm. And when Timoti passed, she carried on farming there. And she actually adopted, she had her own child actually, Dolly, who died in 1919. She was only 20, I think, just about 20, and she was engaged. And living with her, she had adopted two Karatai, her elder brother's son, and she also adopted Maury Allison, her younger sister's daughter. And Auntie Maury was living with her when the news came that Dolly had died, and she said she's never forgotten that wail that she heard from Auntie Alice. And anyway, she lived there farming, but she was, as I said, quite prominent within the community. She presented one of the royal family in 1901 with a greenstone tonga, and really was quite prominent in the community. She moved down to Te Rauoni, one of the first people to live at what now is a popular settlement. So Auntie Alice, so I remember her. She lived to be about 95, died in 1957, and we would go down there. And well, she was getting fairly old when I was young, but and she her first language was Māori, and from my memory of it, she would use the L quite a lot instead of the R, and she had a big horn. so she could hear people. And when her nephew Martin Otaaro was marrying Janice, she had a big magnifying glass and she went up right up to him and looking over at her. I'm just looking at Martin's girl in a loud voice because she's partly deaf. But anyway, she was a wonderful lady.
Kia ora, I wrote to Shirende. 50 biographies in this volume too, and it's quite a big project, big operation at that. Mike, would you be able to explain to us a little bit about the selection progress, process for the biographies, the breadth of entries, covering time, whakapapa, geography, kaumapa?
So, as I already said, there was the founding principle of Volume 2 was that wasn't going to be another sausage fest. So that was that's part of it, that shaped things. But also, we want to reflect the geographical spread of the tribe. So, you know, Te Tai Potene is still a bit light. There's various reasons that we probably could have poked a few more in from Kaikoura, but we do, and there's a very strong showing from Aroturu, right? I mean, it's probably just because there's embarrassment of riches here by way of talent and looks, but, you know, there was an intention to try and have a good spread across the iwi. But of course we have also quite a few people who, you know, married into other iwi, and we sort of followed them into Te Kau Māori as well. That was quite an intentional and important thing. But just two things I would comment on at this point, Wairiki, is that whilst most of the biographies in Volumes 1 and 2 are original, you know, they were tailor-made for these projects, some of them are sort of, not recycled, but they're updated, amended, enlarged versions of biographies that had already been produced as part of the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography project. And so what we did at the very start, you know, back in 2013 or so, 2014, was to do a stock take of who are all the Ngāi Tahu people that currently exist in the DNZB. And what we're doing is sort of judiciously bleeding them out as the volumes go, because we didn't want to front load it all at once. So that helps explain, for example, why your, you know, Tifu Ngatami Parata is not there, but there's that wonderful biography that Matapara and John wrote. I would expect to see that in Volume 3, for example. So and similarly, Edward's namesake, his uncle Rani, he would also, you know, I'd expect to be in Volume 3. So there's that. And it's been a wonderful opportunity, actually, to rework some of those DNZB biographies. So Auntie Queenie, Alison Titeau is another one. And so, see, that was an interesting one because it was her biography, the original DNZB biography, was primarily written by a Pākehā historian, very, very noted scholar of Māori history. But she was unwell, she had cancer in the final stages, and she said, I can't do anything more to this, but go, you know, you do what you do with my, you know, blessings and good wishes. And also Auntie Queenie's moko, so we're, of course, in touch with her. But what we're able to do with, looking at Suzanne there in the front row, she was able to conjure up folk, because of course Suzanne and Matapura's brother is Auntie, father is Auntie Queenie's brother, and my father-in-law's mother is the younger sister. So family photos, which are the four, and that's one of the things that we can do as the Ngāi Tahu Archive that the Ministry of Culture and Heritage can't do, or can't do quite as well, because we know all those, no, that biscuit tin under the bed, that one, yeah, those photos, you know. So there's that going on. The other thing, the second point I wanted to make about the sort of, I guess, the spoke or original biographies is the input or the importance of the input of Te Pai Korako, the Ngāi Tahu Advisory Committee. So at the moment, that's quite a lean machine. It has primarily three people, which is Tā Tīwhini, Emeritus Professor Ethel Anderson, and Pua Media Parata, Guru, or what's your way around the double barrel goes. And so they often say, well, what about this one? Or, the, you know, there's, so there's that input there. And so in a way, it's sort of, they in a way provide a sort of ongoing peer review function for Helen and Takare and I and other members of the Ngāi Tahu archive team. So that's how it comes about. There's what we found after Volume 1, which was really wonderful. You had whānau approaching us saying, I'd like to write something on this person or that person. And so that was something that happened as well, and that's and we anticipate that's something that will grow. You know, I think it's and in a way, the role that Hal and I had, we authored some biographies, but we also sort of edited some or worked with other people to help, rather than just go, well, you give us this stuff and we'll do it. We didn't want it to be the Hal and Mike show. So we perform quite different roles. You know, one minute you're an author, one minute you're an editor, and it's but they're both enriching in their own ways. What else to say about that? That sort of. Well, the only other thing I would say, and this is to some extent it's sort of a pivot into sources that may be preempting a question, but there are sort of two kinds of biographies. There are ones where they're very archive, but they're my favourite ones, right, the ones where there's no descendants, so if you get it wrong, no one's coming after you to tell you off. They're my favourite. So I try and find the ones that know that. But those are largely, you know, text-based. You're going into the archive, you're using papers past, you're using the archive to try and rebuild a life the best you can. At the other extreme, there are ones, I'm looking at Auntie Cess, like Tatane, where you knew these people. You knew these people as warm-blooded, strong, you know, charismatic people, and that's a different thing. And when you're working, you know, ones like that I wrote, thinking like Auntie Bessie Hildebrand and Bluff and others, it's more of an oral history thing, right? You're sitting down with a surviving spouse or children and having endless cups of tea, and you know, that's a different vibe. And I think you can see in the book those differences, the methodological differences create, the end product has a different feel about it, and it's that diversity, I think, which is part of the magic, part of the secret sauce of the collections.
Mm. I might just add to that, which is just regarding the DNZB biographies, is that, you know, those tend to be, you know, worthy elites who have are somehow deemed at a national level to have made the grade to be included there. And all of our people, we think, would make that grade, the DNZB wouldn't necessarily include all of those people. And that's the point of difference for us. But also we have an ongoing reciprocal relationship with DNZB, whereby we are republishing edited versions, updated versions in our books, but they are also picking up ours and publishing them in DNZB. So Erihapiti Murchie went that way from Tangata Ngaitau Volume 1 into the DNZB, and they also, DNZB, commissioned me to write Whetū Tiri Kātani Sullivan's biography, which we, at the same time, published in our book. And there's a very slight difference, I guess, in terms of tone and emphasis with ours. Ours tend to be a bit warmer. They're not quite as clinical, I guess, and we can include anecdote, which I love. Sometimes I kind of hold on to anecdote a bit too much because I just want to include those beautiful little stories that whānau have and pass on. So, yeah.
So I want to pick up on that point as well, that you have, as you said, we have people in the biographies who have a sort of a national level profile or would, deemed worthy by the nation. There are other people who, the way I describe them is they're the little nails that hold the villages together. And and for people living in those villages, they're much more important than a distant prime minister or politician half the time. You know, they're the ones that dig the graves and put down the hangi and bring in the fish, and they are village champions. And so, but I think it's such a wonderful juxtaposition to have all of them there. I mean, it's a bit like when you have a significant hui. It takes all of those, the kai kōrero and the rangawera to make it happen. And you have that sort of combination in the book. And I think one example of that, who is in Volume 2, is Martha Spencer. So Kei Otako, so it's the Irawiti whānau. She marries... And this is the thing that sort of Helen alluded to earlier, when you start looking at chronology and things, it was always said that her husband, who was her, as it turned out, Whakapapa, her mother's first cousin, so they were keeping it exclusive there, it was said that he had had a child before he was married, and we know, and that they had descendants, and we know that whānau. When we looked at it, we're like, actually, I think they had this child after he was married, and so we had to seek clarification on that and word that very carefully. And so those are some of the sort of an example of the ethical things. But Martha, one of her, so she's sort of born and raised at Otago, her marriage into the Spencer whānau takes her to Awarua. She's living at Bluff. And she's one of these women, there's a whole network of Ngaitahu women on sort of both sides of Fovo Strait, up the east coast here, and in Tuahiwi was really the sort of, almost played its kaiapoi role again as a clearinghouse. That they sourced titi, either fundraising and bought titi, or were, you know, buying them off the Bluff Wharf and so on, to descend, to send to the Māori troops on the front lines in the First World War. And so Martha Spencer is one of these key figures in there.
Edward, as a contributor to Volume 2, just want to ask you a little bit about your experience in that, and I guess more importantly, you know, why you felt that was important to contribute.
Kia ora, Waiariki, ngami atu kia koe hinarangi, kia pai tu ora, number nine, Māori tau. Look, yes, in fact, I was invited to, Michael rang me, and I was quite pleased to receive the call because I thought, oh, I'm really thankful to be asked out. And I thought, oh, that's a fantastic taki to be asked to do, very important, about someone who I just mentioned earlier is very important in my life and in our community, but also more to the kaupapa of the book is important to me because picking up on the kōrero around the national biography, picking up on important people, I believe our village stories, our marae stories are so important. Our people held on to their culture, to their traditions, and it was really only through, by and large, I think, maintaining that whanaungatanga, that connection, and people like Auntie Alice, people who held the people together and provided support and, guided the communities. To me, there's a kōrero in there. And so as we continue forward, I think there are many people in that story beside those maitarahi taitikititi, to complete the story. Now, just another wee side story here. For years, our homestead had a lot of taonga in it, and I was a bit concerned because no one's been living in it for some years. Finally convinced the whānau to put all this taonga in the hokken just before COVID. And we had some help. But I was surprised when we were doing the mahi and sorting, people would see a photo of, could be an auntie, or it could be so-and-so. There was no one who knew who they were. Many of the whānau photos, that's my taki, I've still got to go and name them all, but so what I'm saying, there's important work to do here to gather the stories, remember the people, identify what they did, and embellish this kōrero of how our community survived, what makes them tick, and who, you know,
issues.
The kōrero goes into these, into the fabric of, you know, kaitahu. When I was young, I never realised I was in Ngaitahu. I was from Otago. So, you know, we have all these village stories, and but we do connect. We only connected really through the clan, again, compared to when we, perhaps back in the 1920s, and they were doing those earlier clans. But we had gone back into our villages by the 1980s, and it was only really the trust board starting up the claim and then bringing all the tall trees together, and that's when we began. No one in Dunedin would know who Ngaitahu were in 1980 if you said that name. That was, it was very much like that. We became the number one, what do you call it? Enemy, really, because of the clan. People were worried we were going to take the houses and the land and what have you. So what I'm saying is a lot of that kōrero back there and how that journey occurred, how we held on to our culture as best we could, our tikanga, kawa, all of those things, gradual loss of te reo, all of those things that there's a lot of individual stories in there.
I was going to say, Edward, if you recall, the prompt for the arahi thing from me when I read was the tug, right? I mean, you might say, so there's one of Port Otago's tugs has her name on the side, and I needed then a picture of the boat. I'm from Bluff, I got one picture of the boat in the book, so I got my wish. And I think they originally sent one. I think the tug was built in Vietnam, and it was like a. And I said, no, we want the kite in the background. So, I mean, anyway, we got the Otago Peninsula, some part of it in the background. But that was, because I mean, you can tell the story, I don't really know it, but Otago, you would presumably name the vessel?
Yeah, we have been developing quite a strong relationship with Port Otago, who are the major users of the harbour, as you'll know, dredging and shipping and what have you. Potential impact, big impact on our harbour, in fact. And so they understand that in terms of the relationship building includes, right, we've got an important boat coming, can you give us a name? And yes, so the last one we gave them was Arihi. When I was younger, they named the tug Tairoa themselves because of Tairoa Head. Now, I am Tairoa as well, so I can say this, but the hapu got up in arms and went and had a... had it to do with the harbour board it was at the time. Tairoa never lived on Tairoa Head. He wasn't the chief there, it was Karatai. So that was the kōrero, I remember that. And so naming tugs and things is very important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I guess my point was, there is this vessel, it steams up and down our harbour, it has this name on it, who was the person. You know, it's one of those, and it was sort of in a way hiding in plain sight, unless we had photos of the woman, the corded, and she's so inspiring, right? She's kind of the original solo mum, decades before this DPB, and you know, she's a dairy farmer, and all, you know, so it's such. I mean, Arihi for me was one of those examples of a woman I think that current and emerging generations could, you know, sort of draw inspiration from, right? This is someone who knows about resilience and.
Yes, it's very heartwarming to see the Arihi steaming down the harbour. Doing its work and what have you, and in memory of Auntie Alice, who was a spinster, so she has no surviving descendants. Mm-hmm. So it's another way of remembering her, honouring her, and she has an absolute right to be remembered for what she meant to so many people in our community. Yes, and wahine tō to us, yes.
I loved it that the beautiful portrait of her. I must apologise for the images. The clicker isn't working, so I couldn't advance the images to coincide with our kōrero, but these slides in the background, you may have seen the one of Arihi come up, or watch out for it, it'll come round again. That image, an annotation on it says, Ariki Karatai. I mean, I think it's a typo, but I thought it was just a beautiful error.
Yes.
That's a photograph at Otago Museum.
That's right. That's right. Someone, when they were naming it, thought of it obviously as
Ariki.
Ariki. And that was probably right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is probably a good kind of thread into this next question. And to you, Helen, the book is extensively illustrated, and you have described it in recent publications as a tribal family album. Tell us about the significance of photographs to this project.
They're absolutely central to it. And I say to people, I mean, it sounds kind of flippant and silly, but I say just look at the pictures because they're so rich and beautiful. And maybe if you're not wanting, you know, it's not the kind of book necessarily that people will read cover to cover, but it is definitely something that you love to flick through, and so many people will recognise faces and places. It's been a really beautiful part of the collaboration for the project has been the sharing of images, and we're really fortunate that Neil Partington worked on the project with us as a designer, and you know, he's an incredible photographer, and he could digitally enhance a lot of old photographs, like photographs that were much loved, prints that were creased or ripped and that kind of thing, and he was able to bring them back to life and make them look luminous on the page. So there's a lot of images that are from External institutions, probably half of, well, maybe a third of them, but I'd say at least half are from whānau, and they have been, you know, peeled out of albums, kind of frighteningly at times, taken off walls and given to us. Here, you take it in the back of your car, sort of thing. Suzanne, for example, she organised the digitisation of beautiful, beautiful family photographs of Queenie Tito, so the advantage of all of that work being done is that it means that we can share back with whānau digital copies of some of these precious images. So that's been another thing. Also in the book, in addition to photographs of people, are photographs of landscapes, of objects, and of documents. So there's some fantastic images of documents. There's a few maps. One notable map is one that was drawn by Haimona Rakiraki in 1844, and it's the earliest map of the Central Lakes. And this is the map that has on which there are identified beavers, and this is where the mysterious Waitoriti, the beaver, entered the folklore of Southland, is from this beavers, which probably was actually Haimona indicating some kind of bird's nest, we suspect. But little stories like that attach to documents, but also objects. So Tawatini Taiaroa, for example, the beautiful home that her and HK kept at on the shores of Te Waihora at Taumutu, which was this incredible, sort of country gentleman's residence, was full of beautiful objects. And I've heard people in the family say there was nothing Māori in the house. It was all this beautiful linen that was monogrammed. And this photographs, we had them photographed of silver napkin rings, which are engraved TKT, Tinikere Tairua, but she had linen that matched that. She had pillowcases and table linen and things that matched. But also a lot of objects that people have made. So a lot of our weavers, they're like Emma Gruby, I'm thinking of her
kākahu,
which is held here. And the museum here photographed that for us so that we could include it. So many people have assisted with that aspect of it, of bringing the images together. People have just gone out of their way because they get on board with this kaupapa. They love it, and they want to be part of that story.
It's lovely. I reading in here. There was a photo of Ngātaua Martha Spencer, and reads that the photo showing of Ngātaua Martha Spencer is the sole photograph that was rescued from the bin, which is quite amazing. And have there been other stories like that in terms of maybe there's only been one photo of, in that case, and maybe they've come from elsewhere as well, that family just said, hey, we've actually got a photo.
Well, if I could just finish just to round off the Martha Spencer one. So there's that one image, and it flashed through before, she's sort of in a nurse's looking uniform. Edward's late son-in-law, Tahu Pōtiki, he rescued it out of the rubbish. So this, you know, we hear these stories, right, with the 1920s, this one died and their books were burned or buried or booked. You know, this is only in the last few, 10 years that happened, that was going to be discarded. And that was actually an example where he said, I think you should do Martha Spencer. And I said, great, you write it. Who is she? You know, that wasn't a name immediately. The Spencer, but he's pricked up. I mean, it transpired that her husband and my great great grandmother's first husband were brothers, so it was actually my great great grandmother's sister-in-law, but I didn't know that at the time. And so it was actually after Tahu passed away, I got left trying to write this biography. And so it's a different biography. Had Tahu talked about it like he knew her, and he may have had, but so between me, with assistance from Megan, we were able to conjure that up. So in a subtle way, that particular biography is a little mini to Tahu as well. And there are lots of instances like that. But just to come back to your bigger question, we have people, Tukituki is an example, a woman who it disappears from historical memory in the 1820s. So surprise, surprise, we don't have photos of her. So it was, we had to then think carefully about which objects and which landscape photos and which, you know, paintings and things we could use to sort of illustrate that story. So it's quite amazing that, you know, I think some of those, in a way, you know, those ones are some of the most beautiful because you've had to put the most thought into them to really find images. The other difficulty, or the opposite difficulty, is where we've had people who are extremely photogenic, love the camera, and we had like, you know, 100 images to sort from and to try and compress. So there was, yeah, all sorts of challenges. Yeah, just with the images. But one of the things, and Helen has acknowledged Neil, but Partington, and I just want to endorse that, but also the design team at Bridget Williams Books, because they put a lot of care. I learned all this terminology I knew nothing about, and I said, lead that to the edge, take it to the gutter. And all the gutter is like where the pages are all stuck together, and just them shifting a picture 5 millimetres or cropping it a little, it seemed sort of insignificant, but it would make the whole image change. And they did that on every single page. And so that's a roundabout way of offering a mihi to Bridget Williams Books for the key. You know, we couldn't have done this with it. They couldn't have done it without us, but we couldn't have done it to this standard without them.
Mm-hmm. Kia ora, tenapui. Mindful of time, and we do want to give the opportunity to the audience, to you, to ask some questions and or comments. But I guess just to wrap up this formal kind of process. Where to from here? Where are we looking at? Where do we want to encourage the future for this kind of biography, kaupapa with our people?
Go on, pitch it. You know
what? Yeah.
Go on.
No. I mean, all people tell stories, and Ngaito people have always told stories about our people, their exploits, their adventures, their whakapapa, and this is just part of a contribution to that ongoing process of tribal storytelling. I mean, think about place names, just the family names that get handed down through your whānau. You know, that's a story in itself. That's that memory of an ancestor in a family line. Yeah, place names, pūrākau, just anecdotes, baking, you know, recipes you get from your tawa, those kinds of things. I just see that this book sits within the context of all of that, and it's our hope that this is just, you know, this is a contribution to that broader kaupapa of tribal storytelling, but also it's my hope that it prompts more people to do the same, not necessarily in the forum of these books, which we hope to be ongoing, that's really my aspiration for it. We will have a third volume, but we're going to take a little break, and the next book we're going to work on is around Ngaitahu built heritage. So it really won't necessarily be an architectural book, but really the social history of our buildings. Mm. So we'll start work on that next year.
So buildings in its wider sense, so thinking of our marae or native halls, but native schools, whare karakia, I mean, we might take it right down to Te Reo Island houses and whitebait stands, so that, like, you know, because what did they even look like? What were they built out of? How long did they stand for? You know, the you know, widest possible sense of Ngaitahu built heritage. So it's
would that be homesteads as well?
All of that.
Yes.
All of that. I mean, when you had particular, when you think of Tummy's house, or even you know, various, you know, you can think of, well, if you're at Moidaki, you couldn't not go and visit that house, or, you know, so there's obviously a Tiaki too. So we're taking a wide, again, aiming for geographical representation within our sort of 5 or 6 regions, you know, within our takiwā, but it's not just the sort of the high end residences, although they're certainly not excluded.
We've got a couple of microphones up there in the audience, and if you do have any comments or questions, we are going to open it up for you to ask to make comment. If you do have something to kōrero, just raise your hand and then the microphone will find your way.
find the way to you. Kapoe.
Kia ora tātou, e roto i te tēnei whare, no reira tēnā koutou. Tēnā koe me te pukapuka e whakanui ki a koutou, no reira e o tātou, e kaitamihi. I just couldn't help myself. I had to get up and actually congratulate all those involved. Very heartening to see our previous ancestors and so forth, and our mātua and our tau and our paua involved in this great pukapuka. And looking at those times of settlement that took place, and coming from a family that was obviously very, very much involved in it from both parents. And I think now, you know, that time that they spent together following around the different hui and so forth at that time was settlement negotiations. And Mum and Dad would go together. And because Mum was the more paler one, so to speak, so all the papers were given to Dad, but Dad would say, no, it's her, not me. So it's all those little stories like that now comes back to me as well. Those times, of course, we are those that harvest titi, so that's a rich culture of us as well. There's many, many others. So very special to see this, and I thank you for this opportunity for us as the whānau to come here and enjoy this evening and to reminisce and look back at those times. Kia ora.
I was just going to say, for anyone in the room who doesn't know, so that's Tane Davis. So that's Auntie Jane and Uncle Bill's boy. Their photos are running through. And as an example, like we sort of, when our Tangata Ngaitaki series began, we sort of used the DNZB, some of the processes and so on, as somewhat of a template, but we were always very open to evolving, and one of our little evolutions was actually in relation to the Davis whānau. So the DNZB have a rule that they won't authorise or author a biography until the subject has been dead for 5 years. And so if we followed that rule, then Uncle Bill would have been in volume 2 and Auntie Janie would have been in volume 3. And that didn't sit right with us because Auntie Jane had just recently passed away and been buried with Bill back at Aparima. So for us, the tikanga seemed to be that we would bury them in the book because it's alphabetical, right? So they're literally buried in the book together. And so we felt there was a nice symmetry there. So that was an example of us departing from the DNZB tikanga, if you will, and kind of enacting our own. But it was nothing we'd planned, but it's a wonderful little thing. And it'll probably happen again, but the Davis whānau will always be first. So.
I want to thank you because, I've got the book and, of course, the photos and things are lovely. I just have a quick question about Alice Karatai. Did she have children?
Yes.
She did?
She had a daughter, Dolly.
Just the one?
Just the one.
Yeah. Good. I wasn't quite sure. Thank you very much.
I got a question.
For Helen.
Here we go. Hold on. I know my question is to the our kaimātakitaki, our audience. How many of you out there in the audience did contribute to this book? Just raise your hand. Oh, how many of you did contribute to this book, the Volume 2 book?
That includes just answering an email that I sent you.
Sending photos. Yeah.
Kapai kia ora koutou. Yeah, so it is... It is a special thing as we do go through these, the memory bank and I know through the process and Pau Edward had shared a little bit about that importance of contributing something so special and dear to your heart, and I do want to thank those who are in the audience.
I was going to say, you touched on something there, Wairiki, and that was a point, I mean, I mentioned it in the introduction to the book and it's something I talked about recently and I just wanted to emphasise in closing that... no one of our marae or papata purunaka would have the sort of capacity or inclination to write a collection like this. They may have done something similar in relation to their own patch, but not a tribal-wide series. And so this only exists because we have a strong central, presence, because Te Runanga o Ngaitaku exists, right? But all of the skills, all of the kōrero, all of the photographs and so on, the knowledge needed to create it, doesn't exist in Show Place, Addington, right? So that it was having a strong center and our strong publishing relationship with Bridget Williams' books, but having those connections with whānau and the papatapa, it was all of those elements coming together. And when you listen to Edward earlier and listen to Tane now talking about the way in which we sort of rebuilt ourselves as interlinked entities, you know, during the claim process, well, you know, really to Māori and then into the claim. This is the kind of thing that keeps that going, that kind of interconnection going and those conversations going. And that was why I was stressing at the outset the need for this to be a routine part of our existence, to just be something that we just do as a people, because it brings together all the elements of the tribe and they all work in lockstep. So Hal and I couldn't have done this as individuals, or Tāko or Awaro couldn't have done it as a papatapu, Tūrunanga couldn't have done it without all of our support. So I think it really shows us what we can be and the things we can do when all those different scales in the tribe come together. So in that way, it's a very powerful political statement as well, internally.
There are probably intervening levels as well. I always remember 1990, Sesque Centennial, and we, in the 1990. The centennial, 150th centennial of the sale of Tāko block, we negotiated funds from the city to employ Bill Dacher to go and interview Komatua. Unbelievable, invaluable now. When you look back, if that hadn't have happened, what we wouldn't have captured. And in a small thing like the Otako school reunion booklet, cannot believe if we hadn't have done that, we would have lost a whole lot of wee time. So there is probably things that Ngaitahu could initiate at different levels to capture in the interim, because we're not all going to get into the book this time, next time, or the... So there may be things that could be done to capture the gems for future use. Just a thought, Ricardo.
Any further pathway or questions? Kia ora.
Tēnā koutou, he mihi nui ki a koutou mō koutou, mahi whakahirihira. I just have a question. I am a kaiako to Wairiki's boy, and as a kaiako, I'm so chuffed to share Māori knowledge and mātauranga, tikanga Māori and all that kind of stuff. One part I have is, do you have any sort of aspirations or desires to have puka puka that can reach those younger tamariki in our kura across the South Island?
I do.
Yes.
I do. But it's kind of set in abeyance a little bit because I actually haven't had anybody else say that to me. So maybe we should talk about it.
Yes, let's talk about it.
Yeah, you may be familiar with those. There's a book, Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls.
Yes, and those books. That's what I was
thinking. Yeah, I really want to do that with our books.
Yeah.
And do a te reo and English version of the biographies, short biographies, and have our artists do the portraits, if you know that format.
Yeah.
And so that would be a great book because we've got 100 biographies now. So yeah, I definitely want to do that. It's a sort of pet project.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it.
The other thing I should just say on that point, you've been involved with this in Tāke much more than me, but there have been, well, two things. Off the back of Kahuru Manu, the online digital atlas, we had some schools, mainly in Christchurch, that sort of developed and formed their own teachers' notes, and then some of those efforts have been then supported by the archive team. So there's the guy in Wellington, whose name I forget, he was...
Michael Harcourt.
So there are the beginnings of some green shoots of that sort of stuff happening, and I think... the archive team on behalf of Te Rūnanga, we submitted on the proposed history curriculum, and that I think shone a light on the things we're doing. So there are other iwi as well as the Ministry of Ed looking to us, and so we may not have rolled a whole lot of stuff out, but we haven't not thought about it, and there are some little beginnings there, but we're probably going to chase you now to be involved as we do more.
Would we see more of that in the future? You mentioned the whenua hau and our tupuna from there, because you know, since settlement we need to express ourselves more in that connection to whenua hau. We have the puka puka that we've done, those two, but they're being coincided with the Department of Conservation. I think it's time we started doing it for ourselves within Ngaitau, because of that ancestral connection. which is very, very vast now. Say, for instance, myself, Te Whare Tutu, the census last done some 8 years ago, is now in excess of 5,000 people. And the expression of him, Te Whare o Tahi Potiki, says it all, absolutely.
We're here,
absolutely. Do you foresee any more, a vision more of including whenua hou? I think it's important we actually do that.
Mm. Do you mean biographies of the wahine from there, or do you mean broader, more broadly?
More broader, Helen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because it's a key asset to us all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do we have a question? Yes, kia ora.
My question's for Mike or Helen. As between yourselves as editors, how did you decide between the two of you about the skeletons in the closet aspects, the parts of a person's life which you feel needs to be there to tell the whole story but may not be the more sensitive material?
We didn't omit things, let's say, but they'll be sensitively worded, but always guided by the families. And some things you don't need to know, to be fair. I'm thinking of one at the moment. And these are only short biographies, and their intention is to celebrate lives. I would also say read the footnotes, because there may be some of the more difficult aspects of people's lives may be referred to there. But it's not something that we shied away from, and in fact I think that in a lot of instances the whānau we worked with found it, well, cathartic is a word, and to address some of those matters that might be sensitive. And sometimes people have sensitivities about things that they've carried in their families, but actually when they re-look at it, it's actually not that sensitive at all, in terms of, I don't know, multiple marriages or different partners or kids and, you know, those kinds of things. So we certainly didn't err away from it, let's say. But having said that, we don't want to overemphasise this, but we kind of do have a bit of a blacklist of people whom, for personal reasons, we wouldn't include.
It's not that we don't like their haircut. They did things that we would consider objectively awful. Everyone has their... I mean, Tiffany jokes about what he calls his big tuppy red file, you know, which is all the wicked things that he's seen and observed. I don't know what happens when he dies, but, you know, run for the hills. There are various people, but just to re-emphasise what Helen said, people have been surprisingly open about stuff. You know, we weren't ever probing. People were just quite open. And Jane, I mean, you'll be aware of that famous New Zealand Journal of History essay by Michael King in 1973, and he made the argument that Pākehā are a better place to do Māori history than Māori, because Māori too worried about upholding the mana of their ancestors, so they can't be, you know, objective and dispassionate. We found, and to be fair to him, he was reflecting on his writing the biography of Te Puia, and he goes, what happened for those teenage years in Auckland? Don't worry about that. You know, so it wasn't based on nothing, but I think he overreached with that more abstract argument, because I found the opposite, and I think Helen did too in some of those oral history ones. People went there very quickly, and they weren't using this as a forum to kind of fight old battles or stick the boot in or anything like that. They were just very open about, you know, very real about things. But we never took that as an invitation to then write that stuff up necessarily. It's part of whanaungatanga. It's part of having an honest conversation with your cousin. But as Helen said, some stuff is, albeit also carefully worded, you know, buried in the footnotes, because it wasn't, you know, it's not, some of those things aren't unimportant either. But it's a very good question, because it's, I think the bigger point is that we
everything we did was done thoughtfully. You know, there's, I mean, you know, you're a historian, these things don't just write themselves.
And I mean, further to that is what I alluded to earlier, where we discover things that are contrary to the, I guess, the narrative in a family. And that happens just so often because, you know, stories get passed down that are actually incorrect. And this is the wonder of papers past. Not that newspaper journalists are always accurate, but, you know, dates and names and just all kinds of things can be recovered through that wonderful treasure trove.
We're also thinking more broadly about the digital turn. Helen, when we were, she and I sort of co-shared the Paula Taki updated biography, and long story, long and interesting story, but running out of time. But long story short was she discovered a po, a sort of a, you know, wooden carving in the British Museum that Paula Taki had gifted to a British sea captain on Banks Peninsula. In the 1880s?
1883.
And it had been, he returned to England, he put it in the British Museum because that's what he did, and it had been wrongly attributed. So it had Ngāti Hauā, or what was it?
Yeah, it had. They'd just incorrectly transcribed a handwritten letter by Taki, and so they'd rendered Ngaitahu as Ngāti Hauā.
Ngāti Hauā.
And then they had also recorded the name as Ngā Paula Taki. He'd signed his name, Ngā Paula Taki, but they'd recorded Ngā as his first name, and so it just got lost. And of course now all the rapaki whānau are fired up to get it back.
It's created a monster. All thanks to the internet.
Look, sorry we haven't been able to talk about all the people who are on the Arai-Turu list, but those of us who are lucky enough to be on the, people have talked about the claim and the Tauras and the Poas following around, they were influenced by those elder people. That's who made them, and I always marvelled at the dignity, decorum, and so privileged to be a part of that, really. So I've often looked at pictures of people, who are they, what were they like, but really, you look at your elders, I think, and, you know, you get a sense of it, but fascinating, really, time in our history, and so I just congratulate the team who's doing this work to pull these stories together.
Kia ora.
Well, that's a great segue into just kind of closing of this time together, and kia ora, Paul Edward. Before we do close off, though, and before I do mihi to our panel, I do want to mihi to the Dunedin Readers and Writers Committee, the Trust, who have made this possible, alongside our Ngaito Archive team. And I do want to hand the rapu kōrero over to Mary, one from the Trust, to also give some acknowledgements to kei atue.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary McLaughlin tōku ikua. As this part of the evening draws to a close, it's my real pleasure to say some thanks on behalf of the Board of the Dunedin Writers and Readers Festival. First and foremost, I'd like to acknowledge that it is a great honour for us to be hosting an event that celebrates a book that is so significant to the mana whenua of Ka Papatipu Runaka and to all kaitahu whānui. To share glimpses of the family album and to hear family stories is an intimate and rich experience that we wish to hold with care and gratitude, and we're very grateful for the opportunity to do so. To our wonderful speakers, Edward, Wairiki, Helen, and Dr. Michael, we acknowledge your long connections to these biographies, your deep knowledge, and your skill as storytellers, historians, and speakers. Thank you for your thoughtfulness and enthusiasm in putting this event together. It's been fantastic working with you. It's also a pleasure to have such a full audience, and I'd like to particularly acknowledge the whānau whose tipuna feature in the pages of Tangata Ngāi Tahu. Having you here brings the warmth and the strength of whakapapa to the room, and I hope tonight's kōrero will sustain you for some time to come. Many thanks also to our wider audience for your engagement, curiosity, support, and friendship. Finally, my thanks to my fellow board members, our chair, Nick McConnell, has worked hard to make tonight a success, and we're also grateful for the stalwart support of Nicola Cummins, Charlotte Steele, and Foundation member Bridget Showman. Tonight is Bridget's last event as a board member, and I'd like to acknowledge her many years of service and commitment to the festival. Thanks, team.
You know, one of our Ngāti Hine, taking it all the way to the far north by my father, you know, one of our kaumātu up there, one of our karaui, said to us once when we were up in Ngāti Hine, once he said, hey, haere ki te marae, haere ki ngā hui, haere ki ngā kaupapa. Kawe noho noi te whare. He said to us, you know, don't make sure you kids go to the hui, go to the marae, go to the kaupapa. Make sure you're amongst your people. And I guess it's just been tonight that I've actually understood those words. You know, my understanding of a kaumātua is, you know, you've aged in wisdom. And it's those little pennies, I guess, that, you know, you click on as you age and you go, oh, yeah. And I guess this kaupapa has just given me a little bit of enlightenment to from one of our kaumātua from up the far north. And I won't tell them about that because they might go, oh, those ngaitau people, turning you into a ngaita, but you know, it's those kind of things. And I guess, you know, part and parcel to their conversation, he said to us, you know, life is like an adventure, you know, filled with characters, you know. And if you think about when a person passes away at our marae, or you know, at tangihanga, the most common thing you'll hear are the stories, those memories of the character of a person. So, you know, as Paul Edward spoke about, you know, taua arihi, paritoa, you know, with her magnifying glass and the horn. You know, I can just visualize that, you know, that she was a character, and in her old age she was able to, oh, bring that mokopuna Martinez girl over here so I can see her. You know, you can just visualize that, and I guess, you know, there's those kind of memories that we want to create for our tamariki. So there's also visual experiences and memories of our tamariki as well. So I do thank you our kaumātua here, whakaaro nui ki a taua he narangi, me te aroha nui ki a aia, o te anō rā koutou, e tiaki ana I aia, tātou katoa e hui hui mai nei. And lastly, but to our kai kōrero, invaluable memories you know, just a short moment in time for us to be together, but a lifelong of memories, stories, collated in such a small book, but such a big part of our lives and such a big building block into our whare kōrero for our tamariki. Right, hei aha tērā kōrero mō tātou a mō kā uri a muri ake nei.
Dunedin Writers and Readers Festival is held biennially in Otipoti, Dunedin. For more information, visit dunedinwritersfestival.co.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.